TheBook.com.
Hello, once again, everybody. Thank you for joining me here on this Monday, June 20th edition of Bang the Book Radio. My name is Adam Burke, your host for the next hour or so to go over all things going on in the world of sports from a betting focus. Happy to have you with me here on this Monday show. No case of the Mondays in Cleveland as the Cleveland Cavaliers NBA champions breaking a long, long major sports title drought in the city of Cleveland dating back to 1964, but the Cavaliers got it done on the road over the Golden State Warriors. I'll be joined by Chris Stone of Upside Motor. We'll talk a little bit about how that series played out, how things ended up, maybe a little bit about some of the big storylines for the NBA offseason. And then we'll also talk about the NBA draft, which is coming up here later this week, a very quick turnaround. So the offseason really getting hot and heavy right away in the NBA. In the second half of today's show, I'll tell you what's coming up the rest of the week here on Bang the Book Radio. Then I'll also break down the Major League Baseball card for Monday night. So we got a lot of good stuff coming your way to open up a work week here on Bang the Book Radio. But we'll go ahead and bring in our first guest. That is Mr. Chris Stone of Upside Motor. Chris, how are you today, man?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Doing well. No complaints from me. Happy for a lot of my friends that got to enjoy a historic win here for the city. And, you know, things definitely seem to be a little bit different here around Cleveland, that's for sure.
Yeah, I bet. It's a pretty unique situation you all have going on there. First time someone comes back from 3-1 and first title in 52 years or something like that.
Yeah, it's, and to do it in that fashion, I mean, you know, to have Kyrie hit the big contested shot and then LeBron make a free throw seemingly with, you know, one arm because he had that hard fall. You know, it's just one of those things where you're kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop, you know, Curry to hit a back-breaking three and add something to that montage. But it didn't happen that way. And, you know, the Cavaliers, as you said, first team to come back from being down 3-1. And what do you think was the key to their ability to come back here?
I mean, certainly I think the obvious key is LeBron. There's, I think, a nice reminder was sent to everybody that there's nobody else like LeBron in the league, and that when we have conversations about the best player in the league, we should probably not forget that he exists. But, you know, beyond that, you had really impressive performances from Kyrie Irving in the past couple of games. You even had a pretty impressive game, at least an impressive first half, from Kevin Love, grabbed 14 rebounds in the game in game seven. You know, I think the thing that struck me is when they were down 3-1, I always thought it was very possible that they could push it to a game seven, especially with the Draymond suspension in game five. But I really thought it was going to be super tough, if not near impossible, for them to win game seven at Oracle. And so that's the thing that I guess sticks out to me most. And the things that matter last night were LeBron and Kyrie putting together another really impressive game away from home.
Well, in the early betting markets here, we're looking at either Golden State or Cleveland to win the title. And, of course, for Cleveland, there are a lot of dominoes that need to fall. We need to find out if LeBron James is going to stay, for one thing, which, you know, I mean, it seems like every indication would be that he probably would, although he accomplished what he said he was going to do, so if he wants to go somewhere else, he can certainly feel free to do that. Kevin Love, of course, it doesn't really seem like he's going to be back. But the talk today seems to be more about Golden State and the possibility of them making some pretty significant transactions here with this roster prior to the start of the 2016-17 season.
Yeah, I think so. The obvious big question for Golden State is, what do you do with Harrison Barnes? He is, you know, I think correctly identified as not a particularly good player. I think that on Upside Motor yesterday we had a good piece go up about whether or not he's actually deserving of a max contract. And so the question is, do you pay what other teams are going to be willing to pay for him to keep him around? He's not a star by any means on that Golden State team, but he fits the roster really well. And he's important, incredibly important, to playing their best lineup. And so if you're Golden State, can you really afford to let one of those pieces leave and hope that you can kind of find a replacement somewhere? I'm not entirely sure that you can do that. And so that seems kind of like the first shoe to drop for the Warriors is, what do you do there? And then the next question is, what do you do in the front court? Festus Ezeli and Maurice Spates are both free agents this offseason. Andrew Bogut got hurt again. There are consistent health questions with him and whether or not he can stay on the court for a full season in the playoffs. And so I think you're going to see the Warriors doing something to at least improve that front court, no matter what they do with Harris and Barnes going forward. You know, Steve Kerr doesn't seem too into Festus Ezeli, so I don't know that he's long for Golden State.
Another interesting side angle here to this whole thing was Golden State's quest for 73. You know, they didn't really sit anybody during the regular season. They didn't take too many games off. They wanted that regular season distinction. And a lot of the talk, and one of the reasons I'm not a huge NBA fan, is I feel like the 82-game regular season is, in the grand scheme of things, irrelevant, because you've got 10 or 12 teams that know that they're going to make the playoffs. You've got some mediocre to worse teams battling it out for the 7 and 8 spots. Do you feel like with what happened to Golden State here this season, the NBA regular season takes on even less importance next year?
Maybe. You know, I thought this season was really important. It was awesome to see the Warriors go for 73 wins, and you kind of got the sense that they were going to do that early in the season when they got off to such a good start. But I do think that, you know, your finishing placement in the regular season is not particularly relevant, except in situations like Game 7s where you get to host home games. But, you know, the Thunder finished third in the West, and they kind of handled the Spurs out there. And so it was kind of clear that as they were figuring things out through the season that, you know, they were willing to take a few more regular season losses so that they could know what put them in a better position in the playoffs. And I think that, you know, kind of similarly with Cleveland, you had some minutes restrictions and holding guys to certain minutes, and then you kind of unleashed them in the playoffs. It was eerily reminiscent of kind of what LeBron did when he was in Miami, where they were willing to, you know, tone down the regular season and then kick it up for the playoffs. And I don't know that that necessarily means the regular season is less important, but it certainly, I think, means that we can't make our decisions on who's going to win the NBA title based on how well teams necessarily play during the regular season, because as we've seen, you know, in the playoffs, rotations shorten up, minutes get extended, and the best players kind of get to play a little bit more, and that can have some pretty drastic effects in who wins playoff series.
So for the Cavaliers here, I mean, you know, you get one, you obviously want another one. You get a taste of it, you get to break that long drought. You know, now Cleveland wants to become a title town. And, I mean, if you include Stipe Miocic and their American Hockey League affiliate, the Lake Erie Monsters, they have three titles now in 2016. And, you know, a lot of people will put asterisks next to a couple of those and not really pay too much attention to them. But for a city that was so starved for, you know, a winner, they've got three of them here in the span of about 3 months. But for the Cavaliers going into the 2016-17 season, you know, what do they need to do? I mean, do they need to find, you know, that third complement to go along with Kyrie and LeBron? Do they turn Tristan Thompson to that guy? You know, what do you think they do with their offseason?
I mean, I think it certainly hinges on what they do with Kevin Love, if they decide to keep him or let him go or trade him. That seems like the biggest question mark. He clearly, I think, has a place somewhere in the NBA. I'm just not sure his best fit is in Cleveland. He really struggles to play defense as a power forward. And if you do that in the modern NBA, you're going to get taken advantage of. We saw Enes Kanter as a center get run off the floor by the Warriors because he couldn't play pick and roll defense. And Kevin Love had similar problems in this series, notwithstanding his impressive defense against Steph on the last possession last night. But I think that what they do hinges entirely on what they do with Kevin Love. But, you know, the good thing about their roster is they have players who are still improving. LeBron, for, you know, despite getting older, doesn't seem like he's going to slow down anytime soon. Tristan Thompson is someone who you should expect to continue to get better, I would think. I don't know that he'll ever be a big offensive threat, but he can certainly, you know, play really good defense, which we saw in this series. He did a decent job handling switches onto Steph and switches onto wings. And then you've got Kyrie Irving, who kind of had a little bit of a breakout at the end of these finals. He's still only 24 years old, which I think is something that we struggle maybe to remember just how young some of these guys are at times. But I think that, you know, they're going to have to retool some of their bench, but all of it's going to hinge on what they decide to do with Kevin Love in terms of how they construct the rest of their roster.
Well, when you look at the upcoming season, it does appear very top heavy again. I mean, Golden State, you know, probably going to open the favorite with Cleveland, the second favorite. San Antonio would be your third favorite in the 6-1, 7-1 type of range. Same thing there with Oklahoma City, who of course has a very big question mark of its own, wondering where Kevin Durant will play his basketball next season. But after that, there's a pretty big drop off. And, you know, I know over at Upside Motor, you guys do a lot of stuff with young players. You've done a lot of draft scouting reports. You know, is there a young team that could maybe take the leap next year and could be, you know, possibly a little bit of a value pick from a futures odds standpoint?
I don't know that there's any team that I would consider as likely to compete for a title in that range. Like, there's just such a big talent gap between the Golden States, the Clevelands, the Spurs, and the Thunder. You know, you might just take, like, whatever team is the best odds out of those four, because the odds that they can win the title is still going to be pretty good. But beyond that, it's tough to see a really young team kind of taking a leap. Like, maybe, you know, the Clippers add a piece and they figure it out. But in general, you know, and that's not even a young team. That's a team that's kind of already set in stone. But maybe kind of your best bets are teams that could maybe make the playoffs. Maybe you think that a young team like the Timberwolves find their way into the playoffs and you take that as a futures proposition rather than a team that wins the title. Because at the top of the league, like you said, it's so top heavy. There just seems to be enough differentiation between kind of those four teams and everyone else. Unless, you know, like Kevin Durant does something and goes somewhere else. But I think that it would be tough to identify a team likely to compete for a title with those teams. But you might be able to find some value with teams that are going to make the playoffs instead.
Kevin Durant, you know, I mean, that is going to be a fairly big story. But based on the odds that are out there, he's minus 800 to return to Oklahoma City. So it seems like, you know, this is just basically going to be something where maybe you kind of – some of the media will generate some clickbait, hoping to get some readers with Durant going to maybe Miami or Washington or something like that. But it seems like a lot of people expect that he'll just wind up right back in Oklahoma City. Is that how you think it plays out?
That's exactly how I think it plays out. I mean, when you push the Warriors to game seven, you know you're in a good situation. You showed that you can beat that team. I think that he will do the same thing that LeBron did, which is sign the 1+1 contract with a player option for the second year and go back to Oklahoma City and see what they can kind of put together around him in this situation. You know, he's playing with a guy who's certainly another top 10 player, maybe a top 5 player in Russell Westbrook, and they've really got something in Steven Adams that looks to be pretty special. So I think you probably just go back to Oklahoma City, see if you can retool the bench a little bit, see if Billy Donovan kind of figures some more things out during his second season in the NBA, and you just kind of ride with that and go from there. You know, there's no urgency for him to leave Oklahoma City for another contender necessarily. You know, he could go, you know, as rumored to Golden State or San Antonio, I guess, but he has to feel comfortable in Oklahoma City. And if people are thinking about him going east, I'm not sure that he can get on a team that would be good enough to beat Cleveland in a 7-game playoff series, whether that's Washington or Boston. I just don't know that I think those teams would be good enough. So I think I agree that he signs probably a 1+1 contract, stays in Oklahoma City and tries to make the finals next year.
So a lot of dreams came true last night in Cleveland, of course, with a fan base, you know, a lot of the people that were downtown partying, not alive in 1964 when the Browns won the title. And if they were, you know, they certainly don't remember it. There will be a lot of dreams coming true on Thursday night as well, with the first round of the NBA draft. Philadelphia 76ers hold the first pick, Los Angeles Lakers 2, Boston 3, Phoenix 4, Minnesota 5, and then on down from there. But we'll start with the top part of the draft here. And the consensus seems to be that Ben Simmons will go number one overall, the odds pretty heavily in his favor. Do you feel like we get a big surprise here from the Sixers, or will Simmons be the guy?
I think that Ben Simmons will be the guy. The representatives from Philadelphia finally got to meet with him in Cleveland, I believe, during game 6. It sounds like they got the medical information they were looking for. They finally got the sit down they were looking for. It's not clear that they'll get a workout, but I don't know that they really need one. We've seen plenty of Ben Simmons over the course of the college basketball season. Brett Brown has familiarity with Simmons from some relationships with his family. They're both from Australia. I think that Philadelphia, despite no longer having Sam Hinkie around to try to find the superstar talent, you know, that was his strategy, I still think that they're going to look to take the best player available. They believe that player is Ben Simmons because of his potential to be a really unique skill at the power forward spot, where he can kind of create offense and create mismatches that other people can't do at his size. And so I think that we're in for a pretty boring first two picks at least on Thursday. And then I think kind of after that, anything is really possible.
And with the boring first two picks, that would imply that Brandon Ingram going second here to the Lakers. Which one of these guys winds up being the better NBA player? Will it be Simmons or will it be Ingram?
I think it's going to be Simmons still. I just think that the upside for Simmons is a decent bit higher than it is for Ingram. Ingram is a really good talent. I'm questionable on his ability to maintain his three-point shooting percentage in the NBA. He was like a 67 or 65% free throw shooter, which is not really something you like to see over someone who you expect to shoot 40% in the NBA. I also have some questions about how his defense will translate at the NBA. You know, at Duke, once they kind of had to stick him at the power forward spot, they spent a lot of time playing zone. He didn't have a lot of chances to guard in man-to-man situations. With Simmons, I think you have a really unique talent who has and does things differently than just about everybody else at the power forward spot. And if you can build a team around his ability to be a playmaker from that position, then I think you have kind of a unique and different talent than from Ingram, who does a lot of things pretty well, but does them in a way that we've seen before. Simmons does them in a way we haven't seen for a player his size. And so I think that the upside with Simmons is just simply higher than it is with Ingram.
It could wind up being a very, very good weekend here for the Boston Celtics, who have picks 3, 16, 23, 31, 35, 45, 51, and 58. So they've got 8 picks here coming up. And, you know, as you just said, things could kind of get a little bit interesting from number 3 on down. You do a big board over at Upside and Motor. You've got Dragan Bender as your number 3. Is that a higher opinion than the rest of the industry, or is that kind of where he's expected to go?
There's some variability, but I think generally the consensus is that he's probably the third best player in the draft. He's one of the youngest prospects in the draft. He's 7'1". He moves his feet well on defense and can guard multiple positions. If he puts on some muscle, there's a chance that he can block some shots. And then he's also a three-point shooter at 7'. So anytime you have someone with that defensive versatility and that offensive threat to help space the floor, I think that you have a really impressive prospect. I think that what you're seeing, though, is that in these mock drafts, there's some question about whether or not Boston or even some of the other teams in that top 10 feel comfortable drafting international prospects. You know, one of the things that's caused me to change my opinion on what Boston will do is the fact that Danny Ainge hasn't drafted an international prospect in the first round at all during his tenure in Boston, except for Lucas Nogueira, who he traded and he actually drafted for the Dallas Mavericks. So I kind of think that, you know, I know Boston went over and saw him work out and met with him in Israel, but I'm not sure that they feel confident enough to pull the trigger on an international player. But in terms of talent, I think that he's probably the third best player in the draft. He's right there with Chris Dunn, but I think that his youth and the versatility he brings probably makes him the number 3 prospect. And I think that's pretty consistent with what most people think in the draft.
Well, when you look at the Celtics, they're going to be one of the teams from a futures odds standpoint with probably the best chance to challenge Cleveland next year because they've got tremendous depth. They've got a great head coach in Brad Stevens. I mean, that's kind of the question here, I guess, with this number 3 pick is if they take a guy like Bender, it's going to take him a little bit of time to develop. They probably won't get too much of an impact from him right away. If they were to take somebody else, maybe a little bit more polished of a player, I don't know if Chris Dunn is on their radar. I would say probably not. But if they were to take a guy like that with some college experience, somebody that's, you know, a little bit closer to contributing, you know, 30, 35 minutes a game at the NBA level, would that be, you know, maybe in their best interest to go that route instead?
Yeah, it might be. I mean, if their goal is to compete with Cleveland right away, then taking an older player who can step in and contribute immediately makes some sense for them. I'm not sure who I think that would be. If you get Chris Dunn, he's pretty redundant with the skill set that Marcus Smart provides you, and you'd probably have to make some moves in your backcourt, similar to what Philadelphia is going to have to do if they draft Ben Simmons. The only other guy who I really think could contribute to an NBA roster kind of immediately is probably Buddy Hield. I'm higher on Hield, I think, than most people are. I really think he's a talented player. His work ethic is excellent. He fixes one of Boston's biggest problems, which is they really lack three-point shooting. And if there's one thing I feel confident Buddy will be good at in the NBA, it is shooting threes. But I don't know if that's the best option for Boston to find an immediate impact player. I think that if they want someone who can impact the game immediately, then they probably should just trade number three and see what they can get for it. But, you know, ultimately trades are two-way streets, and it's not clear if they can find a partner who values the third pick as highly as they do and can get someone, you know, like a Jimmy Butler, a Kevin Love, a DeMarcus Cousins, or you know, on the lower end of Jahlil Okafor. It's kind of unclear that they can get what they want out of that pick. So, you know, if they stay there, I think maybe you just kind of write off this season in terms of competing for a title, and you look to build up a young core with someone like Bender and put yourself in a position to compete in a year or two rather than right away.
So along with your big board, you also wrote up the draft needs piece for the Pacific Division over at Upside Motor, and we'll go there with the Phoenix Suns, who pick fourth. And obviously whatever happens at three is kind of going to, is, you know, potentially going to dictate what they do at four. But in your look at the needs for the Suns, I mean, you have at least three guys listed for every one of their first round picks. It's not really a big surprise because this is a team that needs a significant amount of help, but there will be some draft props out there, I'm sure. And unfortunately there weren't any out there yet. Looking to see who Phoenix is going to take here at the four spot, and they have plenty of options.
Yeah, they really do. If Boston doesn't take Dragan Bender, I would think that Phoenix will be his landing spot at four, especially after trading away Markieff Morris this year. I think it just makes too much sense for them to grab a versatile defender who can shoot threes and rebound to replace the somewhat versatile defender who can shoot threes and rebound that they traded away. That seems like the obvious pick to me if he's available. If he's not available, I think that there's any number of directions that they could go. Jaylen Brown from Cal makes plenty of sense there. They don't really have a small forward, and if they wanted to play him as a small ball power forward, they could do that as well. I have in the past had Jakob Poeltl from Utah going there because I'm not in love with their center situation, although I don't think that that's a direction that Phoenix will necessarily go. The kind of long shot option, I suppose, is Marquise Chris from Washington, who is the guy who's risen on draft boards probably the most since the end of the college basketball season because of his age, because of his really impressive athleticism and the potential skill set that he brings. I think the safe bet, if Dragan Bender is there, is definitely Dragan Bender. If he's not there, I think it's probably a race between Jaylen Brown and Marquise Chris.
So what would you say then, if we are looking at this from a prop standpoint, if you could, you know, maybe slap a theoretical percentage on it for Boston on their chances of taking Bender, or I mean, I guess we have to leave out the fact that they could potentially trade the pick. I mean, that seems unlikely, but
sure.
You know, things pop up rather quickly. What do you think the chances are that Boston does take Bender and then, you know, we kind of get what could be chaos throughout the rest of the top 10?
Yeah, I think the percentage chance that I would put on them taking Bender now is substantially lower than I would have said a couple of weeks ago. And that's just based on, you know, thinking more about how Danny Ainge approaches the draft and who he's taken in the past. I would say maybe there's like a 40% chance that they take Bender, which I think is still probably higher than the percentage chance that they take anyone else. But I think that, you know, starting the draft process, I would have guessed that that percentage was substantially higher than it is now, or than what I think it is now going forward. So, you know, 40% is like a pretty decent chance that they take him, but just given his history with international prospects, I'm not sure that that's going to be the direction they go, especially if they think they need to compete sooner rather than later.
The rest of the teams in the top 10 are really fascinating to me. You've got Minnesota, who obviously has some really, really strong building blocks up there, and they're going to get a good pick at five. New Orleans looking for that compliment to Anthony Davis. Denver, they had some guys really emerge here at the tail end of last season. Sacramento, of course, we know about their situation and you know, things should be a little bit smoother here going forward. Toronto has a top 10 pick after making the Eastern Conference Finals. So that 5-9 range is really, really tricky. We'll start real quickly looking at Minnesota here. you know, who fits best in Minnesota? Is it, you know, somebody like a Buddy Hield? Do they go, you know, maybe a different route, get another big? I mean, what do they do?
Well, I'll insert the Dragon Bender comment here again, which is that if Phoenix doesn't take him, Minnesota definitely should, because the front court pairing of him and Karl Anthony Towns would be one of the most impressive defensive front courts probably in the NBA in a couple of years. If Bender isn't there, it seems like the most likely situation for them is to try to find a shooting guard who they can put in between Ricky Rubio and Andrew Wiggins, two guys who are not very good three-point shooters. At that point, their best options then are Jamal Murray and Buddy Hield. Both have their upsides for different reasons. Murray is 3 years younger and has a decent bit more potential that he could grow into. Hield is obviously the older prospect, but I think that he is a better defender than Murray is. He has better physical tools to defend. I think his wingspan is 3 or 4 inches longer. He's a little bit heavier. I think he's probably a better shooter and offensive player than Murray is, obviously, at this stage. And I also think you're probably just going to get more effort out of him. One interesting thing is that Hield, being the older player, probably matches up a little more closely to the time frame that Minnesota thinks they'll be able to compete in than Murray does. Murray's probably a year or two behind Wiggins and Karl Anthony Towns in developing and being ready to compete with them. So Hield makes a decent bit of sense for me at 5 if he's available. Bender makes sense. The pick that I would hate for them would be Jaylen Brown, because he's another, you know, wing player who doesn't have any shooting ability from the outside, which is pretty redundant with Andrew Wiggins, and I think would be similar to just having another Shabazz Muhammad on the roster. If Bender's gone, if, you know, Chris Dunn is gone to Boston, then I would think Buddy Hield would make probably the most sense for them at 5. You know, there were also rumors they were talking about trading the pick, so, you know, who knows what Tom Thibodeau does in his kind of first year as a GM. But that's one place where I think they could go to get some help right away, is taking Buddy Hield.
Well, a lot of things need to be sorted out before New Orleans picks at 6, but they've got to get somebody who, I mean, A, can stay healthy, because this is a team that's been really snake bitten by injuries here over the last 2 years. And B, somebody that's a good complement to Anthony Davis. Who would that, you know, if they had their pick, if they had an optimal situation where the top 5 picks went the way that they expect them to, who's on their mind at 6?
I would guess that they're also looking for a shooter at 6, because one of the best ways to complement Anthony Davis's game is to give him the space to work. So it would not surprise me if they're targeting either Buddy Hield or Jamal Murray in that same range that Minnesota is. You know, New Orleans has similar problems to Boston in terms of shooting from outside the arc. So finding somebody who can really help space the floor could make a big difference for opening up their offense. I think that Chris Dunn is also a possibility there. That's kind of his floor in the draft to me, is New Orleans. You know, Jrue Holiday is a really good point guard, but his health concerns are a pretty big red flag. And I think that if you added Chris Dunn to that roster, even though he doesn't bring the same shooting, you could kind of start to build a really effective defensive team with Dunn and with Anthony Davis.
Well, one of the things that always becomes interesting during the draft, and we saw this in the NFL draft with Laramie Tunsil, who, you know, of course, his was a very unique situation with the pot video coming out. But there are always guys that rise and always guys that fall. And, you know, I mean, we see these players in every sport, in every draft, whether they fall because, you know, something comes out as a character concern, or maybe there's, you know, some kind of shortcoming that comes to light on film, some kind of thing like that. Do you see a guy, you know, kind of a top 10 caliber type of player that could wind up really tumbling down the board this year?
Probably. I think that the concerns with this draft class are more injury related than they are character related. And I think in that sense, you have two guys that have kind of stuck out and fallen, at least on public mock drafts and big boards over the past couple weeks. And those two guys are Kentucky's Tyler Ulis, who apparently is dealing with a hip injury that may or may not require surgery. And then Michigan State's Denzel Valentine, who's reportedly dealing with a knee injury that's causing him to slip down draft boards. And I think that those are the two guys who previously, you know, Ulysses' ceiling was probably the end of the lottery, but Denzel Valentine had a real chance to be a late top 10 pick, certainly a lottery pick, especially coming off the season that he put together at Michigan State. And now I think that there's a decent chance, because of concerns about his knee, that he may slip into the 20s, and that some team who's a playoff team is going to get a really good value there if he's capable of staying healthy.
Is there a guy on your big board that you have, you know, decidedly lower than most of the other publications out there?
I think one of the guys that – there are two guys that I would say. One is Washington's Marquise Chris, who I'm lower on just because he doesn't really play defense. He's only played competitive basketball for a couple of years. And I just don't really know that he has the feel to play in the NBA despite having really incredible athletic upside. And then the other guy who's kind of creeping up towards the lottery and got a green room invite is Malachi Richardson from Syracuse. And I quite frankly just have no idea why he's even in the discussion to be a first round pick. He's already 20 years old. He has one of the worst 2-point shooting percentages of anyone in the history of getting drafted. He was an inefficient scorer. He played in his own defense, so we don't even know if he can play man-to-man, which is what he'll be asked to do in the NBA. And I really don't understand why he's getting talked about as a potential first-round pick, but apparently there are a couple NBA teams who really like his potential as a creator from the wing spot and as a shooter. And so he may find himself coming off the board either in the lottery or right after it.
You've got Chris at 12 on your big board, and I imagine you'll have an updated one here coming out within the next couple of days with the draft coming up. Then you've got Malachi Richardson at 41, so he is certainly well down your board. What about the flip side here? I mean, do you see a guy whose stock could rise over the next couple of days and maybe wind up getting taken a lot earlier than people anticipated?
Yeah, I think Wade Baldwin has seen his stock rise pretty high. There are a lot of people who really like him, especially people who do kind of statistical modeling of the draft. He was very productive in a couple of seasons at Vanderbilt. He has great physical tools. You know, he's a 6'4 point guard who has a 7-foot-long wingspan. So there's some chance for him to be a really pesky perimeter defender who can guard multiple guys and also be productive offensively, not only as a passer, but as a 3-point shooter. It wouldn't surprise me if someone takes a shot on him in the top 10 while he's being projected to go in kind of that 10 to 15 range right now. I think somebody could reach up or even trade up to take him earlier than we expect, just given his physical tools, given some of his statistical profile and what he could potentially offer as a starting point guard in the NBA.
Well, of course, I have to ask this question as well. Is there a guy higher on your board, you know, that maybe you think a little bit more highly of than the rest of the industry?
I think that we're probably higher on Timothy Luwawu than most people are. He's someone who I think has slipped in the past couple of weeks on a decent number of big boards. His 3-point percentage has dropped a little bit. And there are some real questions about his 3-point shot being consistent enough for him to be the kind of 3-and-D player that people want him to be. I think there's a decent chance his 3-point shot improves, gets a little bit better. He is a freaky good athlete who has amazing leaping ability. He's quick. He defends really well with a lot of energy and intensity. And I think that we have him as a top 10 prospect right now, and most people have him probably either in the 10 – probably in the like 10 to 25 range. And I generally think we're higher on him than most other people are.
Well, I think you guys do phenomenal work over there at Upside Motor. It's really, really good stuff. You should be very proud of the collection of writers that you have and also the information. I mean, the scouting reports, you know, I've had Austin Peters on the show several times, and the scouting reports, you know, from him and the other writers are just really, really terrific. So if anyone out there is looking for NBA draft coverage, make sure that you go over to Upside Motor to get all of that. What do you guys have in the pipeline coming up here before Thursday night's draft?
I think we're still mostly contemplating or trying to get out scouting reports on kind of the remainder of the first round guys and some of the big second round prospects. I think that's what you'll see mostly coming up over the next couple of days. I should have something out on Buddy Hield here in the next day or two, looking at how he's going to translate to the NBA, which I think is interesting because I'm higher on him than most other people. But in general, you know, just trying to get those scouting reports out so that when people's teams, you know, select certain players, they can read up on them and get an idea of what they might be able to contribute at the next level.
That's at Upside Motor on Twitter. Chris is at C Stone Hoops on Twitter. So Chris Stone, appreciate your time, man. Thanks a lot. Really looking forward to what you guys come up with here into the draft. And then of course, I imagine you guys will have post-draft recap coverage. So looking forward to all that as well. So Chris, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it. Hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Sounds good. Have a good one.
Stuff there from Chris Stone, Upside Motor. And again, I mean, there will be a lot of draft props out there and available, you know, to look at some of these things, look and try to figure out where some of these guys may go. So, you know, I think that you got a good baseline there from Chris and, you know, a lot of good information over at Upside Motor. You know, you can see teams with their needs. They've got those broken down by division, you know, and he talked about it too with Danny Ainge, you know, with that third pick in the draft, you know, a guy that's kind of reluctant to take those European players. And, you know, maybe Dragan Bender is a guy that, you know, becomes a favorite there for that third pick. And you can come up with, you know, a different player option to get yourself some money there in those draft props. So, you know, knowing these teams, knowing the tendencies of the front office personnel, you know, just like anything else, you want to do your homework, you want to do your studying. I thought that was a really good way to open up some NBA draft coverage here for this week. We'll be right back after a quick note from DSI Sportsbook.
This segment of Bang the Book Radio is brought to you by the Bet DSI Sportsbook. DSI is one of the industry leaders in customer service, wagering options. It offers an exclusive 300% deposit bonus to readers of BangTheBook.com and listeners of Bang the Book Radio. Simply sign up with a promo code BANG300. Again, that's BANG300 and start winning today.
Make sure you take advantage of that Bang 300 promo code over at DSI Sportsbook. Also, the Bang 10 promo code where you get a $10 free bet simply for signing up. So as far as the rest of the week goes here on Bang the Book Radio, we're going to have Cole Ryan's final edition for the 2015-16 NBA season of Betting the Buckets on tomorrow's broadcast. He'll wrap up the NBA Finals. Also talk about the futures odds for the upcoming season. So definitely make sure you tune in on Tuesday for that. Should hear from Wes Reynolds at Wes Reynolds and the number one on Twitter on Wednesday. We got the BMW International Open. We also have what is the PGA tournament this week? I know that they're at Congressional in Bethesda, Maryland, so I do know that. But you know, going to be probably a little bit of a watered down golf event here this week because you've got so many players taking a break after the U.S. Open. It's the Quicken Loans National, over at Congressional. But you've got the Open Championship coming up here July 14th through the 17th in Scotland. So that's the next big major. We got the WGC Bridgestone next week, which should bring out a ton of players to Firestone Country Club in Akron. So, you know, a lot of guys will take this week off and look ahead to that WGC event. But, you know, with these different events and players that maybe you don't know about, a really good time to talk to Wes and get his takes on some of these players and some of the odds. Thursday, should have Jordan Biaki of SB Nation. Bring him back. We've got a full slate of motorsports coverage. We've got all the circuits in action this weekend. Formula One, IndyCar, also NASCAR and Xfinity Series. So should be a good segment there with him. The site redesign over at bangthebook.com, we're expecting that to be done here this week. Ran into a couple of issues with our betting center information. We've got, you know, mock sports book up over there and some matchup data and all those types of things. But you know, working out some of those kinks, still doing a little bit of beta testing, making sure that everything is good to go. But it should be good to go here, you know, in the next few days. So hoping to get that redesign coming out at bangthebook.com. If you haven't noticed, we've got some great soccer coverage going on over at bangthebook.com now as well. We've got several picks and previews each day from one of our new contributors. So, you know, good to have that. Also, we'll get some Wimbledon stuff here later in the week. We've got the Arena Football League, the WNBA, and of course, we've got my Major League Baseball stuff every day. So, you know, even though the only major sports league going on from now until the last week of August, you know, is Major League Baseball, you know, we still have you covered over at bangthebook.com. So don't forget about us. I know that you probably scale back a little bit here in the summer, and I don't blame you. You know, you certainly should, because everybody needs that breather. Everybody wants to get geared up for football season. But we still have all the coverage that you need over at bangthebook.com. I do want to mention here, we are taking a week off from the show during the Major League Baseball All-Star break. obviously there's just not a whole lot to talk about. Won't be able to get too many guests on the air, so we will not have shows. We will be dark that week for the Major League Baseball All-Star break. That's July 11th through July 15th. So we'll take a little bit of a break from the show, give everyone involved with the process a chance to recharge, you know, as we get ready for the football seasons. We'll see what happens. We will still be doing shows, you know, here prior to football season, but I don't know if we're going to be scaling back. We're still trying to figure out what exactly we want to do here, you know, but for sure, one thing that we do know is that there will be no shows during the Major League Baseball All-Star break week. So 3 weeks from today, you know, we won't have any shows that week. But, you know, in the meantime, we'll continue to provide you great content both over at the website and here on Bang the Book Radio. So an interesting Major League Baseball card here today. We've got 10 games, nine of them after the show coming up here tonight. We have seen a line move in this Arizona-Philadelphia game, and you know that's not really a big surprise because Paul Goldschmidt out of the lineup today for the Diamondbacks. So the Diamondbacks go from a slight road favorite with Shelby Miller making his return from the disabled list to a pretty clear road dog with Philadelphia in the minus 115, minus 120 range. Again, you know, anytime you've got those day games, you want to make sure that you're aware of what the lineups are going to look like and some possible line moves in those situations. As far as the rest of the day goes, I'm going to skip all the way down to the bottom of the day because you've got Steven Strasburg against Clayton Kershaw tonight at Dodger Stadium. Strasburg's never been more than a plus 115 dog. He's a plus 165, plus 170 dog here today going up against Kershaw, which it's Clayton Kershaw. So, you know, that's going to happen. We have a total of 5.5 in this game. And in fact, 5.5 minus 120 was the opening number at the Greek. It's now 5.5 with the over minus 120. But you know, you really don't see too many of those outside of the playoffs. But a matchup between Kershaw and Strasburg, certainly one where you could justify a total of 5.5. And, you know, I wrote this one up in my picks analysis piece over at bangthebook.com. But Clayton Kershaw this season, a 158 ERA, a 164 FIP, 199 XFIP, 133 strikeouts in 108 innings. He's walked seven guys, 133 strikeouts, seven walks. This guy's on another planet. It's insane what he's doing. Not only that, 243 BABIP against because this year he's using his slider a little bit more at the expense of his fastball, still throwing his curveball about the same rate. His slider on the season, 20.7 runs above average per pitch FX data. There aren't enough adjectives to describe how good Clayton Kershaw is. I mean, he's ridiculous. But Steven Strasburg's pretty good in his own right. 290 ERA, 283 FIP, 283 XFIP, 31.9% strikeout rate. I think Mike Maddux has done a fantastic job with this Nationals staff here. A lot of the guys for the Nationals really improving with the changeup this year. And, you know, we kind of see this a little bit with Don Cooper in Chicago, where, you know, this is a guy who's trying to encourage his starters to pitch to a little bit more contact. Now, I don't think that that's a really good idea necessarily because you've got a guy like Chris Sale. You don't want to handcuff him and you know, make him do something differently. You've got Jose Quintana, who, I mean, obviously he keeps improving. He's very, very good. But, you know, we see sometimes these entire pitching staff shifts in ideology. And we're seeing one here with the Nationals and a lot more dependence on changeups. Tanner Roark's been a guy that's thrown his changeup very effectively this year. Strasburg's done the same thing. Gio Gonzalez has always thrown his a lot. It's something interesting that you want to watch for. And, you know, maybe what you want to do here, you can go over to FanGraphs, and they have pitch type values for teams offensively. And this is a mark of weighted runs above or below average. And you've got the Red Sox, who are the best team at hitting changeups. It's not a big surprise. The Phillies are the worst. The Giants are fifth worst. The Reds are seventh worst. Nationals aren't hitting changeups very well. But you can look at some of these matchups here and, you know, that's an extra level that you can do that the odds makers are not doing. So you can go in, look at some of these pitch values. For example, you look at the Phillies, minus 23 runs above average on the fastball. So they're 23 runs below average on four-seam fastballs, 13 runs below average on two-seam fastballs, below average against cutters as well, well below average against sliders and changeups. So you know that the Phillies are a really bad offensive team. And again, you know, for those that maybe aren't too well-versed in sabermetrics, what I always like to say, and I will continue to drive this mantra home, is that, you know, all they do is provide quantifiable evidence of things that your eyes are already seeing. You know, so you know the Phillies are a bad offensive team. Well, how bad are they? Well, they're really, really bad. They're below average against everything except for split-fingered fastballs this year. And, you know, you can use that information to your advantage from a maybe from a team total standpoint. You know, if they're taking on a guy like Strasburg, who's throwing a really elite-level changeup here this season, that's not a good thing for the Phillies because they're not hitting anybody's changeup, let alone an elite-level changeup. So you can use some of these for team totals, I think. And I think in team totals, you know, we had MLB Dream Picks on the show last week. I think team totals are a really underutilized way, you know, to play some of these games, particularly with the regression analysis handicapping that I use. You know, if you think you got a pitcher that's due for some regression, you know, maybe you go with a team total as opposed to betting a side. Yeah, because the starting pitcher's due for regression, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything about the starting pitcher's offense. You don't know if he's going to get run support. You know, maybe he's due for regression, loses a game 4-2, 5-2, you know, some kind of thing like that. So you can use these pitch values for team totals. I think that's something that could have, you know, a lot of impact as we get into the summer months here, you know, because when there's nothing else going on, odds makers can be tighter with these Major League Baseball lines. I mean, we're going to start to see some more moves because we're going to see, you know, professionals doing some baseball stuff, whether they're keeping sales up, you know, their clients are out there moving lines around, you know, that type of thing, because there's really not much else for them to do. I mean, they're all just out there preparing for football season, but, you know, it's either in their nature to get action or they're selling picks to quantities of people that are going to move some numbers. And, you know, with the style of handicapping that I use, with how deep I like to dig, there aren't a whole lot of people doing that. And maybe the success rate isn't always there. You know, there are probably some inefficiencies. I mean, I'm doing things that a lot of people don't do with their handicapping. So, you know, kind of uncharted territory. There's some guess and check in there. There's some trial and error. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't always work out. But, you know, I'm at least, at the very least, I'm broadening your horizons and showing you a different perspective. And you can decide, you know, if you want to use more traditional things like trends, if you want to go deeper into some of the sabermetric stuff, you know, whatever you want to do, it's completely up to you. But that's why I try to arm you with as much information as possible, you know, to give you different ways to look at some of these things. Tampa Bay and Cleveland tonight. Drew Smyly taking on Josh Tomlin. Indians about a minus 125 favorite out there in the market. And, of course, some really positive vibes in the city of Cleveland. A lot of the Indians players partying up at Mike Napoli's place last night for the Cavs game. So we'll see if there's a little bit of a hangover, pardon the pun, with the Indians here tonight. But coming off of that sweep of the White Sox, but a tricky matchup here for the Indians, I think. So the Tampa Bay Rays are not good against right-handed pitching this season. But the one thing that they have been good at against right-handed pitching is hitting for power. And the Rays have hit for power really all year long, really from, you know, both of the splits. So this year, Tampa Bay, third in home runs against right-handed pitching with 75, but they're batting .229 as a team. They've got, I believe it was a .308 on base percentage when I looked earlier. 300, actually. It's not even .308. They have a .308 wOBA, so that's where I got the .308 from. But they're hitting for power. They're striking out a lot against righties as well. But Josh Tomlin, not a strikeout guy, and a guy that lives around the plate, throws a ton of strikes. So this is not a great matchup for Tomlin here tonight, I don't think. Even though the Rays are 21st in wOBA, you know, they're 21st in wOBA because they're not walking very much. And a lot of their balls in play aren't finding holes. But they're hitting for some power. So when you look at it from that standpoint, I mean, if you have a team that's they're 11th in slugging percentage with a .229 batting average. And again, slugging percentage is total bases divided by at-bats. That tells you just how much power they're hitting for. And with the Rays here, you know, and that amount of power, it's a good matchup against a guy like Josh Tomlin. On the Indian side of things, they've really struggled against lefties here this year. They're 20th in wOBA against lefties, which is a bit of a surprise because, you know, they went out and wanted to get guys that could hit left-handed pitching. They got Rajay Davis. They got Marlon Byrd. They got Mike Napoli. And, you know, obviously Byrd's suspended now, but they've had a lot of trouble hitting lefties. And Drew Smyly is a really good lefty. I mean, he's got above average swing and miss rates on most of his pitches. He's a guy that's coming off of a really, really good start through 6 2/3, struck out 12, gave up a Nelson Cruz home run. That was the only runs that he gave up. He's had some issues. He's had some command problems. He's been really inconsistent. But the Indians don't see Smyly a whole lot. And one other wrinkle about this series is that Rays manager Kevin Cash was a bullpen coach for the Indians back in 2013. Then he took the Tampa Bay job. And Terry Francona kept Kevin Cash very, very close by, sort of mentored Kevin Cash a little bit. So Cash knows, you know, the Indians have had some transition, have had, you know, quite a bit of turnover here in their lineup since Cash was on the coaching staff. But, you know, he's familiar with these hitters. He's familiar with the system. So maybe that's something that helps Tampa Bay a little bit. I do like the Rays here in this one tonight. I hate myself for it because obviously I want the Indians to, you know, ride this wave of momentum. But, you know, I think if you look at this game objectively, you know, you can see where Tampa Bay definitely has some value here. Definitely has some, you know, some really compelling matchup advantages in this game here tonight. We've seen a big line move between Seattle and Detroit. Nate Karns up to a minus 140 favorite. That's a straight fade of Mike Pelfrey. That's hardly a big surprise. The Tigers not really doing much of anything here of late. Not really doing a whole lot offensively. Not really doing a whole lot from a pitching standpoint. Yesterday lost 2-1 and 13. So, you know, they've really spent the bullpen a lot over the last few days. They had Andrew Romine pitching the other night on Saturday night. So he had a position player pitching. I believe that's his second pitching appearance this season, but not a big surprise to see Seattle money pouring in against Pelfrey. Pelfrey's been awful this season. The Mariners are really good against right-handed pitching, so that's probably your least surprising line move of the day. One line move that did catch my eye, Kevin Gausman and Derek Holland. So we've got the Orioles up about 10 to 15 cents here for this one, up inching closer to the minus 120 range. And this is surprising because you've got a guy in Gausman who, you know, he's solid. He's not spectacular. Going out on the road to a tough road environment, Globe Life Park there in Arlington. And, you know, you usually don't see line moves of this nature. But with Texas here tonight, you've got Derek Holland on the mound. And, you know, Holland's had a really strange season. He's made 13 starts this year. But he's got a 5.14 ERA, a 4.94 FIP, and a 5.43 XFIP in his 68 and a third innings. But he's got two ERA destroying starts. He gave up 11 runs in 2 2/3 to Toronto earlier this year. The start right after, he gave up 4 runs in 2 1/3 to the White Sox. Now, you can't take away those two outings, but in his other 11 starts, 3.41 ERA. Now, part of that is batted ball luck because he's got a really low strikeout rate, not a great walk rate. He's given up a lot of hard contact, a lot of barrels. So, you know, he's kind of a tough guy to figure out, really. But one of the things I think that we're seeing here, and I think we're going to see this from the Rangers, you know, over the next several weeks. Remember when we were looking at the Phillies, also the White Sox, and we were looking at both of these teams earlier this season, you know, they had great records in one-run games. They had winning records despite negative run differentials. Their Pythagorean win-loss records were so much different than their actual records. The Texas Rangers are currently that team. They're 45 and 25 on the year. Second biggest lead in baseball, 8.5 games here in the AL West. But they're 6 games better than their Pythagorean win-loss record, which is a win-loss record metric, you know, calculated by using run differential. They are 16-4 in one-run games. 14-4 here in the month of June with a plus 17 run differential. So a lot of people expecting regression to come for the Texas Rangers, and I agree wholeheartedly with that. You look at the Rangers on the season here. As I said, you know, they're 16-4 in one games. Their bullpen is 24th in XFIP at 4.29, and have the third highest FIP in the league at 4.65, 4.76 ERA. That's the third worst mark in the league. So how is a team supposed to sustain a 16-4 record in one run games with one of the worst bullpens in Major League Baseball? That just doesn't happen. So the Rangers are a team that I think you're going to see a lot of money come in against here over the next several weeks. You know, as I talked about on last week's show, you've got three guys in the top 20 for the Rangers: Cole Hamels, Martin Perez, Colby Lewis. with in terms of ERA and FIP discrepancies. So low ERAs, high FIPs, because they're getting very, very fortunate, you know, on batted balls, on sequencing. Now, look, I will say this. The Rangers are almost 33 in defensive runs saved, and they're second, I believe, here in UZR, ultimate zone rating. And in fact, in UZR by 150, they are first at 10.9. So defensively, the Rangers have been phenomenal, and that's really, really carried them this season. It's kind of what happened with the Kansas City Royals. You know, they have a below-average starting staff. They wound up really building up the bullpen, you know, with the Wade Davis acquisition and all that. But defensively, they were fantastic. And that was something that really, really helped them out, really helped out that pitching staff. You know, they got some timely hits in a contact-based offense, really overcome some of their shortcomings and some of their deficiencies. And we see that right now with the Rangers. I mean, they're 11th in WOBA, and they've got a great home hitting environment. They are tied for 18th in weighted runs created plus. 18th. So they're a mediocre offense, below average offense. Their starting rotation is due for regression. They've got one of the worst bullpens in baseball, and they're 20 games over 500. That's not how things are supposed to work. So I think that you'll definitely see the market keep coming in on coming in against Texas over and over again, particularly when they play decent teams and Baltimore is a solid team. So I thought that this was really interesting to see a line move like this, and I think that we're going to continue to see money come in against Texas because the Baltimore offense really hasn't been as good as you would expect against left-handed pitching. I mean, you know, they are 24th in WOBA against lefties, and they've got guys like Manny Machado, Adam Jones, Mark Trumbo. You know, Chris Davis obviously hits righties better than lefties, but they've got some really good right-handed sticks. Jonathan Scope is another one, and yet they're not doing much against lefties. But here we've got this line move on Baltimore. I think it makes complete sense. I think if you fade Texas here moving forward for a little while, I think you're going to be in some decent shape. Now, maybe you do that with serious prices. Maybe you do that on a game-by-game basis, you know, based on the matchups. But Texas is a team that should start to fall off here soon. I mean, all the indicators are there. This is a team that has overachieved greatly. If you look at, like, third-order win percentage over at Baseball Prospectus, they're nowhere close to 20 games over 500. So I think Texas is a team that you look to go against here when you get some opportunities to do that. Colorado and Miami coming up here tonight. You've got Paul Clemens on the mound for Miami, Jorge De La Rosa going for the Rockies. Marlins a minus 120 favorite with Clemens on the mound, who's making just his fifth career start. Drafted in 2008, he's had a handful of 48 career appearances and 14 starts at AAA this year, 430 ERA, 413 FIP, so not exactly anything special. But the Rockies haven't hit lefties all that well this year, particularly away from Coors Field. Jorge De La Rosa has struggled here. But again, you want to make sure that you're digging deep. If you just go and look at De La Rosa's home road splits this year, his road splits are terrible, but he's only made three road starts. And all three of them have come in good hitters' parks. He pitched at Fenway, he pitched at Great American Ballpark in Cincinnati, and they pitched at Chase Field in Arizona. So this is a guy that really hasn't had the best draws on the road. He's coming in on the Marlins here, and I get it. You know, I understand it. I also think that there's maybe a little bit, I don't want to call it a situational angle necessarily, and it could be kind of a reach. But for Colorado here, they played a day game yesterday. This is a wraparound series with a night game tonight. Nightlife is generally undefeated, and I feel like the Rockies probably went out, you know, watched a Cavs game at some South Beach club, some kind of thing like that. So Colorado may have really partied it up and enjoyed the weekend down there in Miami. Got out on the beach, you know, I'm sure guys doing what guys do out on the road when they're professional athletes. So I think there's a good chance that Miami winds up being a play solely because of that, because I don't think Colorado is going to be all that invested in this one. They don't go home after this. They go up to New York. So, very interesting game here. I kind of agree with the line move, even though Paul Clemens certainly nowhere near any kind of certainty. But for Colorado, I mean, they're not playing for much this year anyway. So, could be a situation where the nightlife really does come into play. And again, I mean, that's not quantifiable. It's not something that you're going to find on too many shows here or in too much analysis. But I do think that there's certainly a possibility that that could be the case there for the Rockies. So, good way to start the week here. A lot of NBA draft coverage. That's always good to look ahead at that kind of thing. Gave you some different wagering angles here from the Major League Baseball side of things. So hope you enjoyed things as we kicked off another week here on Bang the Book Radio. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and I will talk to you again tomorrow.